Howdy, y'all. Good morning to everybody. I have to let you know that there's another Southerner here. We can't let Roy Holiday hog the whole show. You all know Archie Bunker, don't you? There's Archie, Edith, Gloria, and Meathead, all in the family. They were a successful TV series because they were a family. Though there were problems, they dealt with those problems as a family unit, strong, powerful, together. They dealt with the issue of Edith, the mother, being raped, and all of the internal turmoil and problems of her own self and the family. They also dealt with her rebate on the prunes and whether or not she should give back the money, of how she was getting wealthy on the rebate of the prunes, a little bit illegally. They dealt with Gloria's abortion. And of course, bigoted though he was, they always dealt with Archie and his racial difficulties. But all in the family related to people. It was a very highly successful TV series. People were attracted to it because it dealt with the issues of life and because it was a family affair. And though there was a bigot at the head of the family, there was a certain lovableness about him. And the family was together, and they stuck together. And even though they argued with themselves, they stuck together and upheld each other. And it was a very successful TV program. But now Meathead is gone, Gloria is gone, and Edith is gone. And Archie's still the same old bigoted fellow he always was. He's tending a bar now, and he's the ears for the drunken community. TV critics say that Archie's place is going to be a flop. They don't expect it to be successful. And Archie is learning the lesson that this feast emphasizes, that people are attracted to a strong, powerful, united family. That a strong, powerful, united family is very, very important. That is the lesson that God emphasizes every year to you and me at this feast. You'll find this in Deuteronomy 12, beginning in verse 10. One of the lessons that is emphasized over and over and over again every year at the Feast of Tabernacles. Deuteronomy 12, beginning in verse 10. Instructions given concerning the feast. Speaking to Israel, it says, when you go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God gives you to inherit, and when he gives you the rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. There you shall bring all that I command you, burnt offerings, sacrifices, tithes, and other offerings for your free will and otherwise which you vow unto the Eternal. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you as an individual, your sons, your daughters, those under your charge, men servants, maid servants, and the Levite and other individuals who might be single individuals among you. We are not all families at the feast, but we should be one big family together. There are many individuals here who are not married, who do not have children, who are not family people. I'm sure they feel like two thumbs on the same hand. They feel unattached. There are many divorcees, broken family individuals here. And so logically, they don't come here as a family. But the information given to all of us is that we should come together as a family. And that we should look upon ourselves as a family. And those who are blessed and honored to be able to have families should be able and willing to take within their family other unattached individuals and help them feel as if they are a part of a family. Because whether or not they feel like they're a part of a family, they really are. You're a part of the family of God, the begotten family of God, the church of God, that spirit organism that is a far-flung organism around the world, but yet it is a family, and it is destined to become a literal family that all the world will know about in the future. He cautions us in verse 13 not to take and sacrifice our offerings in every place that we see, but unto the place which God has chosen. There you shall come, there you shall bring your offerings, and there you shall enjoy what he has. In verse 17 he says, you may not eat within your gates the tithe of your corn or wine or oil or firstlings of your herds or flocks, but you must eat them, the tithes, before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses. A caution about misuse of second tithe, because it will result in unhappiness, suffering, and maybe even sorrow of the children and the rest of the family, because they are not able to enjoy the feast as a family, because you as the father did not save the second tithe and therefore cheated the family of their God-ordained blessings. You must eat those tithes where God chooses to place his name. It says you as the breadwinner, your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, the Levite that is within your gates, the family and all other individuals that you're able to bring within your feathers, underneath your feathers into your nest, and help them to feel as if they are a part of a family, because they are. This is a tremendous blessing to come to the Feast of Tabernacles and to provide for your family in a way that you're not able to the rest of the year. I assume that most are not able to provide in an abundant way as you are here. And that's a part of the reason for the saving of the second tithe. And one of the tremendous lessons we learn at the feast is to emphasize the family. He emphasizes this again in Deuteronomy 14, beginning in verse 22. Again talking about the subject of tithing. Because money answers all things. It is not God. We should not worship it. But it's difficult to live without it. And it is difficult to have a truly happy family without the proper expenditure of money. And with the price of Levi's and Adidas Superstars, an awful lot of money these days. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22 says, you shall tithe all the increase that your seed brings forth in the field year by year, and you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place which he chooses, the tithe. Now the other tithe, the first tithe, was to be given to the priests for the work of God. This was to be eaten by the individuals at a particular place. The tithe of your corn, of your wine, your oil, and firstlings of herds and flocks. And he says you are to do this in order that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God. Not to stand in petrified fright of him, but to have a healthy respect and a deep abiding love for the being that commands you a proper way to live. Then he talks about if the way is too far and you're not able to take it in your hand, then you're to turn it into money and take that money to the place which God commands. And in verse 26, you shall bestow that money for whatever your soul earnestly desires it should be rendered, not lusts for. Oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink. You would be surprised at how much sometimes drinking properly can enhance family conversation. And I'm not talking about drinking until you get loopy and happy, but just having a nice glass of wine, sitting and talking about the good of the feast and the good of life, it can be an aid to family happiness. Now that may sound strange to some people, but it is. I'm not talking about excessive drinking, but a glass of wine with a meal, just a glass of wine as a family together, rather than going out to some darkened bar where adultery is going on all the time, and they're trying to make everybody on the bar stool and trying to get sot drunk and wasting their money on alcohol, having it at home in a family atmosphere. Father, mother, and the children, teaching your family to drink properly. They will never think it's fun to go out and get drunk, because they can have it at home with the blessing of Almighty God and with the blessing of the father and the mother, because they know it's right. Oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink, or whatever your soul earnestly desires, and you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice. you and your family. Sure, there is a satisfaction in using your own money for yourself, but I believe there's a greater satisfaction in using the money that you have for the satisfaction of other people under your care that you're responsible for. And it is a tremendous fulfilling feeling to use your money properly for your home. The feast emphasizes good times. We are physical. We relate to the physical. The physical is not evil in any sense of the word. It is the improper use of it that is a sin. The feast emphasizes good times, good food, good drink, many activities. The family and isolated individuals brought within the family together. Because you see, the Feast of Tabernacles pictures the time when the family of God will rule this earth and will help develop other individuals into solid, stable families. One of the curses of America is the breakup of the family. And I don't think we who have the blessing of God in the family of the church realize the suffering that is going on in this society because of divorce, which is the dissolution of the breakup of a family. In some areas, it's one out of every four marriages. In other areas, one of three. In other areas, in metropolitan areas, every other family is affected by divorce. And it may be even higher in some other areas. Aid to Dependent Children, which is a national recognition of the breakup of the family, is becoming a burden. Welfare, which is another national recognition of breaking up of the family, is becoming a curse because our nation, a Christian nation, is growing in the breakup of the family. TV programs cater to the, and I hate to use the word, gay single life, but it is used these days. One TV program called The Odd Couple, Can Oscar and Felix Make It After They've Been Kicked Out by Their Wives? People are attracted to that to a degree, but not in a magnetic way and in a long-standing way as they are to other family programs. Three is a Company, or even TV Guide says the cuddly stud, John Ritter, is just the same offstage as he is on stage. And that's attractive to people, the breakup of the family. And yet, ironically, some of the most magnetic and powerful and high-rating television programs emphasize the family. The Waltons has been a long-standing, high-rating television series dealing with the family in the poverty-stricken times of the Depression era of the United States. Yet some people say, if the Waltons had poverty, then they never knew what poverty was because they always have what they need. Whereas some, if not many people, didn't have half what the Waltons have. But anyway, it's a father, a mother, children, grandparents, a strong, united, powerful family that works together. And it enjoyed a tremendous rating because people are attracted to that. You are attracted to a strong, united, powerful family. There is a certain something when I'm in a family that is a good, solid family. I feel at home. I feel comfortable. I like that feeling. The TV program Big Valley was another one where, and I've forgotten the family name, but anyway, Jared and all the others, a mother, two or three sons, and a daughter. They were good-looking, they were wealthy, they were moral, they stuck together, they fought for what was right, they were loyal to each other, and it was a very attractive television series. Another one was either Bonanza or Ponderosa, whichever they call it, and I understand I had a joke told on me the other day about this, about the little kid that thought one of those Cartwright boys was one of the first fellows that was created. He knew it was either Adam Hoss or Little Joe, one or the other. because he had watched it so much that he thought that was about all there was in life. But it showed a father and sons fighting for what was right, sticking up for each other, loyal to each other, believing in each other, backing each other, living through the good times and the bad times. We allowed our sons to watch that because they were good looking, they were strong, they were loyal, they were faithful, they were a family. And they made an awful lot of money because people watched it. And Adam, like the original Adam, lost all of his blessings when he thought he could make it on his own. And he left the Cartwright family to go on his own, and life has never been so good because Ponderosa went big and Adam went down. When he left the family, he didn't make it on his own. Little House on the Prairie, little Joe got a good idea from Ponderosa. He has parlayed that wealth into super wealth on Little House on the Prairie. A father, a mother, children. The traumas of a family working together. People are attracted to that. Ruth showed how powerful is the family attraction, not only in the individual who wants to know his lineage and to know where he came from and who he is, but of individuals who are touched by the family. You don't know them at all, but you are touched by the family. Alex Haley has become a household word because he fought to find where he came from, to know who his family is. I guess he's a worldwide name now. People know about Kunta Kinte. They never heard of him before. They didn't know him from Adam. But they know him now. The first Adam. They tell the difference between him and Adam Cartwright. They didn't know him, but now they know him. They know of him. They relate to him. They love him. They're for him. Because there's something about a family that is very appealing and attractive. You're drawn to it because it has what we all want. Security, stability, affection, love, loyalty, backing, and an interplay of exchange of ideas and personalities. You can't beat that. Webster says that a family is composed of members of one group living in the same house. Now, that's, generally speaking, Webster's definition. I disagree with that. A family is more than just a group of people living in one house, because we have a lot of old people today on welfare shacking up so they won't lose their welfare checks. And they're not a family. They're foolish old people. There are many communes where hippies, men, women, and children, babies of who knows whom, living together in one communal house, but they are not a family. A family is more than just a convenient sexual arrangement and relationship. A family is a group with a strong bond, a common heritage, common goals, sharing that basic relationship on the foundation of that common heritage, common bond, and common goals, including a home, including food, including work, including play, including laughter, including alcoholic beverages, including all kinds of activities. That's a family. It isn't just a male and a female and a lot of kids housed together in a building called a home. Because a home is more than a house. People think that this building is the church of God, but it isn't. You're the church of God. They ask us when they find out we're a minister, well, where is your church? They would laugh us if I said, well, we got about 500 different locations in Indianapolis. That's strange. Never heard of that many churches in one town. Well, we got 500 people, and they all combine into the church. We are the church. The house, the auditorium in Pasadena is not the church. This is not the church. We are the church. A family is not just living, or family is not just the house. It is the father, the mother, the children, and that bond and that heritage and that relationship that go together. That is the family. The power of the family and the family bond is explained in Ecclesiastes 4, beginning in verse 7. Solomon, who had 1,000 women, or at least the use of, if you may put it that way, women don't like to have it put that way, but that's the way Solomon had it. In Ecclesiastes 4, verse 7, he, who I'm sure did not understand this to the same depth and degree that he wrote it, but we can drink in from it nevertheless, said he was talking about the futility of certain things in life that he saw. And one of the most futile things he saw was, in verse 8, there is one alone, there's not a second. A pro football quarterback, unmarried, rich, with a slew of women behind him, but no children, no loved ones, no family, no home. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he has neither child nor brother, yet there is no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Neither says he, what am I working for anyway? Who am I providing for? It's just for myself. I got enough. Why am I working so hard? For whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? There is also vanity. It is a sore travail. Then he says, two are better than one. Speaking of the superiority of the family, because they have a good reward for their labor. There is a tremendous reward in laboring together as a family. And there is a blessing in being able to be together as a family. He says, if they fall, and who doesn't? If you live alone, and you have your peaks and your many, many valleys where you're depressed and discouraged with life itself, to whom do you turn for solace and consolation and encouragement? The wall? It won't talk back to you. If they fall, which we all do, the one will lift up his fellow. My best companion and counselor and advisor is my wife. Now, I was a bachelor for a long time, and I slept alone for a long, long time, and I got accustomed to sleeping in bed alone. I didn't like anything touching me. When we first got married, my wife always wanted to stick her toe over on my leg. Get that foot off my leg! I don't like it. But you know, I like it now. It's a welcome feeling in the middle of a cold Indiana winter night. Very welcome. I look forward to that foot. Not in the middle of my back to push me out, but on my legs. But woe to him that is alone when he falls, for he has not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. Well, I put my joke in there ahead of time. But how can one be warm alone? Well, thermal underwear is one way, but that's not the best. But I prefer a wife to thermal underwear. If one prevail against him, two shall withstand him. I've never taught our sons to fight, but I've never taught them to run from a fight. Stand back to back and face what's coming. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Speaking of the family, it speaks of one alone, two, the husband and wife, and three, the family, three or more. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. You cannot defeat Adam Cartwright because you got a fight with Papa Cartwright and all the others. You can't defeat Herbert Armstrong because you're fighting with the whole Church of God, the spiritual family, and because God the Father is backing us. When you attack one, you attack the whole church. When you attack one in a family, you're attacking the whole family. And you have a family to deal with. So he shows the attraction and the powerful bond of a family. It is very, very important. Now, of course, I realize I'm speaking to many, many singles here who may cry yourself to sleep at night in your thermal underwear. I'm sorry I didn't make your situation. You say, well, there's no hope for us. Yes, there is. I said a family is important, it's wonderful, but it's not all there is in life. Because whether you realize it or not as an individual, there is a certain family fringe benefit when you come into the church of God. Whether you realize it or not, you're coming into a family. And you become a member of a large family. God explains this to the individuals who will never have children, will never be married, in Isaiah 56, that they need to understand these lessons, even though they may never participate in the beauty and blessing of it, they need to understand it and realize that situations and circumstances have disallowed that blessing in their life, but still there is a future blessing that they can have, and they're also able to participate in the family atmosphere in a fringe way now. He says in Isaiah 56, 1, thus says the Eternal, keep your judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the individual that does this and the Son of Man that lays hold on it, that keeps the Sabbath. Now, of course, one of the first things when you come into the truth is the Sabbath. You learn about the Sabbath and the holy days. And that's very important because it tells us why we're here and where we're going. Neither let the son of the stranger that has joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, well, the Eternal has utterly separated me from his people. Many of us have had to give up our family when we came into the church because of geography and going to Ambassador College, or because our family thought we had abandoned them, and so they gave us up. And you think, well, it's a bittersweet blessing to come into the church because I gain the truth and lose my family. What reward is there if I lose my family and yet I gain the truth? He said, don't say that. Don't say that I'm a dry... And then he said, neither let the eunuch, who either because of congenital deformities, because of the sins of parents, or because of the evils of other human beings perpetrated upon an individual, do not let the eunuch, who will never be a father, who will probably never be married, will never know the joy of a family, do not let that individual say, I am a dry tree. In essence, there's no hope for me. Yes, there is. Maybe not completely and totally as God intends, but a tremendous amount of happiness for you because of the gift of the church, which maybe you don't realize yet, but there is a wonderful gift of being in the church. Here's why. For thus says the Eternal, unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths and choose the things that please me and take hold of my agreement, even unto them will I give in my house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Well, of course, they're going to be in God's family. They're going to be an everlasting son or daughter of God. They're going to be a part of the family of God forever and ever and ever, serving the Father and the elder brother, the Son of God, as sons in the family of God forever. They will be then in a family forever. I said there's a gift in coming into the church. Jesus explained this in Luke 18, beginning in verse 28, where Peter was lamenting the fact that he had given up an awful lot to come into the church, to the truth. And, of course, Jesus knows that. And God does not ask us to give up something for nothing. Possibly you've not thought of it that way, but for everything you give up, you are given many things in return. If you've had to give up a family, then you have, as Jesus explained, a family many times more greater than you gave up. Luke 18, verse 28. Peter said, well, we've left all we had and we've followed you. Now, another place it says, what shall we have? He was wanting to know what he would have coming back because of what he'd given up. Well, of course, Jesus did not say, well, that's tough. You'll just have to take the empty bag. God does not ask us to give up something for nothing in return. Don't ever misjudge God that way, that he takes and never gives. Jesus said of a truth, in other words, I'm not lying to you. There is no one who has left, given up, abandoned, or had to give up house, parents, brothers, wife, children for the kingdom of God's sake. In other words, to have been separated from their loved ones because of having to accept the truth. Or not, I shouldn't use the word having to, because of the blessing of receiving the truth. There is a separation between you and your family. He said, who shall not receive manifold more in this present time, then on top of that, an eternal life. We are promised a family when we come into the church of God, because you're a begotten son of God, and everyone around you who is a begotten son of God is your brother or your sister. You're a part of that family. You have the same father. You have the same mother, which is the church of God. You have the same older brother, Jesus, the firstborn in the family. You have the same spirit. You have the same goals, the kingdom of God. You have the same family heritage and traditions. Now, maybe you never looked upon yourself as a part of a family like that, but you are. And you're destined to be a part of that family forever. If you make it, that's what you're going to be, a part of a family forever. Jesus said this about coming into the church in Matthew 12. You probably would think that it would have been a blessing to be in Christ's immediate family, to have been James or John or Joseph or one of the sisters, and to have had an older brother such as Jesus. He says in Matthew 12, verse 46, that you are a part of his family. When he was dealing with certain individuals, while he talked with the people, his mother, his brother stood outside desiring to speak with him. Then one individual said, well, your mother and your brothers are standing outside. They want to talk with you. But he said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? So then he stretched forth his hand toward his disciples, and he said, consider this point. There is my mother, and there are my brothers. For whoever does the will of my father, that individual is my sister, my brother, or my mother. So if you're trying to obey God's truth, then you are a younger brother or a younger sister to your older brother, Jesus the Christ. And you're a part of that family. And because you're a part of the family, you're defended, you're honored, you're protected, and you're blessed, and you're provided for by the Father. And anyone who attacks you is attacking the family. And the family, including the father and the older brother, are going to come to your rescue. Jesus talked about this in Hebrews 2 via the prophecies and the writings of Paul, that he looks upon you as a family, as a part of his family. You're not mentioned by name, but you're mentioned by category. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, it became him, that is the Father, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. For both he that sets apart and they who are set apart, which is you and me, are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them his brothers. I don't know if you're ashamed of your brothers. The Kennedy family, the Joseph Kennedy family, had a daughter who was somewhat mentally retarded. They were not ashamed of her. They treated her as an equal. They tried to make her life as good as possible because she was a part of the family. God, Jesus the Christ, is not ashamed to call you his brother. Now, he may be embarrassed at some of the antics of the little brothers. You know, once you get up to be 15 or 16 and you're now mature teenage individual, and you've got a little brother who's 10 or 8, and he's still interested in kid stuff, but you're getting up, you may be a little bit embarrassed at the antics of this little kid brother or kid sister because you're getting older. But I don't think you're ashamed of them because they're your brother or your sister. Jesus is not ashamed to call you his brother or his sister. It says, saying, I will declare your name unto my brethren. In the middle of the church will I sing praise unto you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children which God has given me. You are looked upon by Christ as a part of his family of brothers and sisters that he is going to present to his Father. This is a lesson that we ministers have to learn too, that we become the caretakers of a part of the family. And we should not look upon you as just an entity, but as our father or our mother or our younger sister or younger brother. Paul told this to Timothy in 1 Timothy 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 1. And I don't think a minister can truly be successful and effective until he begins to look upon the members of the church of God from this viewpoint. Paul said to Timothy, who was a younger individual, Timothy, do not rebuke an elder. Now, maybe an older man, having not the same amount of truth that the minister would have, would make some foolish mistakes. Well, you old coot, why don't you wake up? That's a no-no for a minister to treat an old man like an idiot. Treat an elder as a father. Treat an older man in the church as your father. It would be dishonoring your father to treat your father that way. And the younger, and then treat him as a father. The younger men, treat them as brothers. Not as someone that you can delegate everything to and lord it over them, but as a younger brother in the knowledge of the truth, one that you love and honor and respect and want to help to bring him up to a level of knowledge and understanding. He said, treat the elder women as mothers. The younger women treat as sisters. Some ministers have treated them a little bit too intimately as sisters, ruined their entire life and wrecked their marriage and wrecked their reputation, and have made a blotch and a spot on the church of God. They pay that penalty. It is far more rewarding and satisfying to treat them as a part of the family, as an honorable entity of the family. He said, honor those widows who are widows indeed. The ministers are admonished to treat the members of God's church as members of the family, because we are a family. Mr. Rod Meredith tells a story years ago when his daughter Elizabeth was very young, and Mr. Meredith, I think, was taking a shower. The doorbell rang. Someone was at the door. Elizabeth answered the door. She came back and said, Daddy, somebody's here. I let them in. Well, you know, he didn't want to walk out in his birthday suit to welcome the church member into the home. But Elizabeth assured him that it was okay because they were in the church and a part of the family. In her mind, as long as they were in the church, they were in the family. And if they were in the family, that was all right, because quite often family members walk around with a towel draped pretty carelessly, that they wouldn't do so anywhere else. Have you ever considered the wonder of a family? Sometimes we just take it for granted, but consider and look at the chronological story flow of the building and founding of a family. There was a time when you weren't married. You didn't know who your wife was going to be or your husband. You didn't have children. You were just alone. Through the selecting of a mate, the taking of an agreement to be faithful and loyal to each other, through the act of love and the sexual relationship, the uniting of an egg and a sperm, a new entity is created. A child is born. And if you're not careful, many of them are born. And through the bringing into this world of other lives, and the nourishing of the food, the clothing of them, a unit is created, a family, a father, a mother, brothers and sisters. It's a marvel how a family is created. They share a special relationship. And then one by one they die, the father or the mother, the brothers and the sisters, and they're dead. And the family is no more. There have been many families that trod this soil, I'm sure, hundreds of years ago, but they're not here today. They're gone. They're in the grave. They're resting. That's why the resurrection is going to be such a fantastically joyful family reunion. You know, to a degree, we've gotten away from family reunions in the United States, but family reunions are therapeutic. They really are. They're rewarding and satisfying. That's why Christmas was such a joyful time for many people, and why it was a sad thing to give up the keeping of Christmas, because they didn't keep it, many of them, as Christ's birthday. They kept it as a family reunion. I remember many family reunions at Christmas, at Easter time, family reunions at grandfather's wedding anniversary. I still remember those times. They're very enjoyable memories as a youth. Though it was a bittersweet family reunion this last spring, just after the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, my older brother, who was only 5, 6, 7 years older than I am, died very suddenly from kidney disease, and I had to hurriedly fly back to West Texas for his funeral. There were 6 years, I guess, between us, but still we were fairly close. He was the older one. I was a little kid brother. He didn't want to be around too much. But I saw my father. My mother is dead for many years. Other brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, relatives, and was able to share in a family relationship that is still a very pleasant memory, because even though I abandoned them to join Armstrong's church, they enjoy my presence, and I certainly enjoy being with them. My brother and I were fairly close, though we were several years apart, and for him to die when I was not there was a shock. I cried when the Protestant preacher preached him to heaven. I wanted to raise my hand and ask if I could say something, but I didn't. I stifled the urge. After the funeral, going back home to visit, eat, and chat for a while, I went back out to the graveside and sat, had a Bible study with myself on the resurrection of the dead, and walked over to the grave, and I said, I know you don't hear me, and I'm not trying to talk to the dead, because I know that's a sin, that is, to try to communicate with the dead, because they don't hear, they don't see, they're not there. But I'll see you in the resurrection. He was not a member of God's church, did not have God's Spirit, but he will be in the resurrection, and I will be with my brother again. This time the kid brother will teach him a thing or two also. But it was a touching thing to realize that, and very comforting to know the comfort of the resurrection and the fact that it will be a family reunion. I have a technical question for you that has been in my mind for a long time, and it deals with the family and the loss of a beloved member of the family, and the resurrection of the dead, and the family reunion. My mother introduced me to the truth in 1955, and it was through her that I learned the truth, humanly speaking. She lived by it as well as she could. I went off to Ambassador College in 1956. She kept the Sabbath and some of the holy days, but because she was alone, there was no church then, I'm sure she wasn't able to live by it fully. In the fall of 62, she asked to be baptized, but was not able to respond to the baptismal tour's letter because she was dying of blood cancer. Now, she kept the Sabbath and some of the holy days, and she did all she could to live by God's truth. She requested to be baptized, but died before they got there. Now, will she be in the first resurrection or the second? I'm going to look and see. That resurrection is going to be a family reunion. I hope she's there. You know, she didn't have God's Spirit technically because she wasn't baptized, but I'm sure God's Spirit dwelt with her, or she wouldn't have known the truth. So it'll be a very joyful resurrection. a tremendous family reunion. This past summer, when I went back for the track meet, I took my younger son out to the graveside, and you know, it's not a huge thing, but just show him the grave of his grandmother, the woman who gave me life and introduced me into the knowledge of the truth, who nursed me to give me life. And there underneath the soil are the decayed remains of the human being who gave me life. Well, it'd be nice to be reunited with her in a resurrection and in a very wonderful, loving family reunion. I think sometimes the coming into the church has almost destroyed family ties because we think it is an evil thing to have anything to do with the pagan unconverted family now. And that's ridiculous. We should be even more loving and better member of the family now than we were before. And we should be able to reestablish those family ties because we're not crazy. We're sane, we do know the truth, and we should love them and realize they just don't know the truth, that's all. And do our part in reestablishing family ties. The gift of God's church is being in God's begotten family now, and in the kingdom of God and the family of God forever. I said one of the curses of modern America is the dissolution of the family. God abhors that, and he talks about how much he dislikes it in Malachi chapter 2, beginning in verse 16. Because he, more than we, realize the scars, the hurt, the pain, and the suffering, the trauma of individuals who are the recipients of a broken family. Malachi 2:16 says, the eternal, the God of Israel says that he hates putting away. Now he does say, Jesus said, except it be for. There was an exception. There are reasons for divorce and remarriage that do not make it adultery. But even so, if it fits within the exception, that does not erase the scar of a broken home. Even though it is legal in God's sight to have to choose between two different mommies or two different fathers, leaves a scar that is never erased from a young child's mind and does irreparable damage to that young mind, not to mention the parties of the divorce. They say sometimes it takes a year for a divorced person to get his or her head on straight again because they just cannot cope with being rejected. Because that's what it is. They were rejected. And to be rejected kills us. If you thought that everybody around you could care less whether you lived or died and rejected you, why is there a reason to live? We want to be accepted. And being a part of a family includes that knowledge, that taken for granted knowledge that you're accepted. You're a part of a group. You're accepted within it. And when that group is dissolved and broken and shattered, it leaves irreparable scars, even though it may be legal, even in God's sight. And he says that God abhors putting away. In chapter 3, verse 1, he talks of the messenger that God would send to prepare the way for the eternal. And in verse 5 of chapter 3, he says, speaking of Christ's return, I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, which of course breaks up families, the false swearers, those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, that is, orphans. God says he is going to deal very sternly with those who oppress disadvantaged members of a broken family, who take advantage of them. They're going to have to answer to God because he is their shield, their fortress, the one who will comfort and bless them. And in chapter 4, verse 4, he says, the last admonishment before Christ's return, he says, remember the law of Moses, my servant. No, it wasn't the law of Moses, but Moses was the human mediator between God and the nation of Israel. God's law, the Ten Commandments, he says, do not forget. Now, two of those laws, honor your father and mother and don't commit adultery, which breaks up a family. Preserve the family. And he said, don't forget that law. Well, our nation is trying as hard as they can to forget it. And though they may eulogize the single swinging life, those single swingers are very unhappy. He talks of sending an individual or group of individuals before the day of the Lord, and those people would turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the children to the fathers. You see, there has to be a change in heart before the family can really succeed. Because if the family continued to be dissolved and shattered and broken, the earth would be smitten with a curse. God's message is a message of hope about the family, the physical family and the family of God. I've read that in this business world, if you intend to succeed and climb the ladder of executive corporate success, big salary, then you have to sacrifice your family. Now that's ridiculous, because success should incorporate a happy, successful family. But they say that those, and it does seem that way, J. Paul Getty, who's termed successful, was married to his job. He could not keep a wife because he was married to the job, not the woman, and she didn't like that. No woman does. And he said he'd give all his wealth for a happy marriage, which includes a family. But, of course, that would not buy a happy family. He needed to realize he needs to get a divorce from his job and be married to his wife. It seems ironic, and I know it isn't God's way, yet ironically it seems to have been that way even in the ministry. You may have heard the joke about the mobile ministry, where we moved every 2 or 3 years and we traveled 30 to 50 to 60 or 70,000 miles a year. We're gone many times from home at night. And the minister was married to the church, not the wife and children. And there are those children in the church of God who have been neglected and who didn't think the church of God was so wonderful, who have gone their own way and have rejected the church of God because they didn't see any difference in that in some other profession. Daddy was always gone and didn't have time for the family because he was busy. And of course, it's an easy excuse to use. It justifies your inattention to the family. Well, honey, I'm busy. I don't have time. If we in the ministry do not have time for our families, then we are not fit to teach others about the family. How, if someone comes and says, how do I get my kids to obey me? And you say, don't ask me, I haven't got the foggiest idea. One of the first things Jesus is going to do when he returns to this earth is to restore the family atmosphere. Again, it's a bittersweet thing. You'll find this in Jeremiah 30, beginning in verse 3. Where it talks about the return of the house of Israel, and some people say it doesn't exist, but I guess it does if Christ is going to lead it out of captivity. I don't see how he can lead a non-existent entity out of captivity. But it says that's one of the first things he's going to do. He knows who it is and where it is. And I think you do too. But there are those that say it doesn't exist. Jeremiah 30 verse 3 said, the days come, says the Eternal, that I will bring again the captivity of, which means bring back out of captivity, my people, Israel, and Judah. And I will cause them to return to the land that I gave their fathers, and they shall possess it. Skipping to verse 7, it says, alas, for that day is great. It's talking about the time of Jacob's trouble, the time of the great tribulation. Verse 9 says, they will serve the Lord their God and David their king. Speaking of the resurrection, chapter 31, verse 1, says, at the same time, that is that same particular period of time, the day of the Lord, the return of Christ to this earth, the latter days. Then verse 4, it says, again I will build you, and you shall be built, O virgin of Israel. You shall be again be adorned with your tabrets, and go forth in the dances of them that make merry. It's happy. A very happy time. Talks about planting vineyards And in verse 8, he says, I will bring them from the north country and gather them from the coasts of the earth, the blind, the lame, the woman with child, her that travails with child, a great company shall return. They'll come weeping with supplication. He said, I'll lead them in a straight path because I am a father to Israel and Ephraim is my firstborn. And then a particular verse in verse 13 that talks about the family atmosphere. Yes, there will be broken homes. There may be homes where the father and the mother have died in a future concentration camp, but there will be a family atmosphere because there will be the group of Israel, God's people, brought back together to establish physically a foundation under the Spirit-born family of God. And in verse 13 he says, then shall the virgin, there will be some virgins coming through the great tribulation, they will not all be ravished, then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance. Now we have dances in God's church, and sometimes they're happy and sometimes they're a miserable flop. Quite often the women say, there's nobody to dance with. All the guys are holding up the walls. You know, they usually meet in a building that has very weak walls because all the guys have to go over and hold up the walls. And so the women sit around with a glum look on the face because there's nobody to dance with. Well, the commentators say, ironically, many of the women in Israel danced alone. Maybe the old Israelites had the same problem that we did. They tied both shoes together when they went to the dance and they couldn't step. The woman danced alone. Is it a sin to dance alone? No. Now today they may think you're queer, but let them think what they will. Dancing is an expression of joy and happiness. And then it says both young men and old together. Now, whether it means the old men will be dancing with the young girls, I suppose the old men would like that. I don't think the young girls would. But it talks of dancing in a family atmosphere. Restoring a family atmosphere. I think sometimes even in church we may have lost that principle in part of the family atmosphere. Why does dancing always have to be done in a dark, dark place? With music so loud that you can't even hear what your partner is saying to you. It shouldn't have to be. Why do you have to get almost drunk before you can enjoy dancing? Why can't a son dance with his mother? A father dance with his daughter? Why can't a brother and a sister dance together? Why can't dancing be an expression of joy and happiness in the family atmosphere? Would you dance with your mother the same way you dance with the girl in a dark place? Would you dance the same rhythmic movements with your mother that you would with this pickup? I don't think so. Your mother'd slap your face. It talks of a family atmosphere. Roger Staubach stands out among pro athletes because he's so straight he squeaks. Many of the other quarterbacks are cuddly studs who leave a string of fillies in their path. And they brag openly the many intimacies they have. When Staubach won the Most Valuable Player Award, and it was one of those what you call it, cars, you know, that they roar down the streets in. He requested a station wagon because he has a wife and some girls, a family. He says his night out of fun and pleasure is to take the wife and girls out someplace. Now, they may laugh at him because of that, but they don't laugh when he throws the bomb because he's a family man. You never hear of any affairs with him. Pete Rose became famous. He was going to win the series for Philadelphia. They came in almost last. His wife has sued him for a divorce because of the alleged affair with a lady in Florida or wherever who claims that her child is his son. It seems like when they get famous, they shed their mate. They don't have to. Roger Staubach didn't. They don't laugh at Staubach because he's solid. He is a family man. And he has lasted as long or longer than the swinging fellows. And he has statistics to prove it. The family is a very powerful unit to which you are attracted. When Pope John Paul II came to the United States and spoke at the United Nations, he said, "No more war, never again." Do you realize what war has done to the dissolution of the family in the world? It has almost destroyed it in many places. One of the things this feast pictures is the establishing of God's kingdom, at which time Pope John Paul II's words will become a reality, no more war. You'll find this in Micah 4 in verse 3. Micah 4 in verse 3, it says, if I can ever find Micah, they are minor as far as volume, as was said, very powerful in content, but it's still hard to find them. Let's see, there's Hosea, Joel, and Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. All right, we got it. Micah chapter 4, verse 3 says, he, speaking of Christ, shall judge among many people, rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn. And they do have to learn to hate and kill, because when the war is over, the opposing fighting boys get down and have a beer party together. They don't want to kill each other. They'd rather have a beer together. They shall not learn war anymore. They shall sit under domestic situations. Can you comprehend what the world will be like when there is no more war? When the father doesn't have to go off to fight some politician's war? When the sons don't have to go off to defend their country against something they don't fully understand? When children don't have to become orphans because their parents were killed? It will emphasize the family. The family unit will be established and maintained without the disruptive action of war. No nation can survive when the family is destroyed. It cannot, and it will not. The family lays a foundation for future generations of growth. You've probably never heard of Mr. and Mrs. Morgan Lane, a family in South Louisiana. Mr. Morgan Lane, like Bobby Kennedy, multiplied beyond all human comprehension. I don't mean that as a slam. I love the man and his wife very much, but they had quite a few children. You never heard of them, but two of their sons today helped produce that beautiful music that you enjoyed, because Morgan Lane worked hard to provide a living for his children and put many of them through college when it was a strain on his pocketbook. He labored to keep the family intact. He sent many of his children to college because he was looking to the future to build and produce something, and he has. Many of them are in the church, talented musically, and they helped produce something of beauty for you today, because Morgan Lane produced something in his family. You have heard of Ray Dick, the man here on the festival grounds. I've listened to his three sons talk about their papa's experiences in rearing them as boys, you know, and the tricks that he used. When there were problems, he would gather the sons around and just explain it to them. "Look, boys, if this fails, I'm a failure." Well, they don't want to let down their father. He wasn't just trying to manipulate them, but he wanted to produce something, and now all three are in God's work, producing for the work of God, because he laid the foundation of a family and he built something of value for God's work. The feast emphasizes the family. Now, I'm not talking about happy, happy family with the Lord in your eyes and things like that, but good, solid, hard work to produce a family. In Deuteronomy 6, the first 8 verses, it talks about when your sons and daughters ask you questions. It says that when you rise up and when you sit down, when you walk here and there, you're to talk. The little things in life sometimes produce the most sound families. Have you heard the old country and western song, "The little things and the happy things in life"? That's the poor man's gold. And it is. Talking with your children. Many families are broken because they cannot communicate. God says when you walk, talk. When you sit, talk. When you eat, talk. Maybe talk in your sleep. Talking and communicating brings a family together. It may help solve those difficult things if you deal with the little ones. The little times help an awful lot. A family is an extension of you as an individual. Look at this in Psalms 128, the first 6 verses, which of course is the whole psalm. Psalm 128, beginning in verse 1, speaking of the picture of a beautiful family. "Blessed is everyone that fears the Eternal, that walks in His ways, for you shall eat the labor of your hands." God talks in the Proverbs about, "He who troubles his family shall reap the wind." But if you build and develop a family, then you will enjoy the results of that forever and ever. "Happy shall you be, and it shall be well with you. Your wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of your house, your children like olive plants round about your table. Consider that thus shall be the man, he'll be blessed that fears the Lord." That is, by living by God's ways, you will build and produce that. "God shall bless you out of Zion, and you shall see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Yea, you shall see your children's children." Now, when you're young, you don't think much about it. But as you get older, family becomes very, very important. Very important as you grow older to have a family to turn to. The person who does not have a family member at all to turn to is very, very empty. "You shall see your grandchildren and peace upon Israel." The gift of the church is that you come into the begotten family of God, headed toward the born family of God. Another friend's benefit and blessing, if you're blessed and honored, is to have a personal family. It's our responsibility to build and to develop that family, because it is headed to the time when we'll be in the family of God. So the lesson of the feast, a lesson, not the lesson, but a big lesson that God intends we get, is the emphasis on the family. So during the rest of the feast, and especially during the rest of your years, reflect on your family, the family, and determine to improve your family during the feast and during the coming year, because if you do, who knows the many blessings you will have and the many, many blessings that other people will reap because you built a family.